Welcome to Discourses upon the Existence and Attributes of God, Volume 1 by Stephen Charnock. We continue to read at page 304 for this reading. This Reformation MP audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many free resources, as well as our complete online catalogue containing classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, DVDs, CDs, digital downloads, MP3s, and much more at great discounts are on the web at www.swrb.com. Also, please consider, pray, and act upon the important truths found in the following quotation by Charles Spurgeon. As the Apostle says to Timothy, so also he says to everyone, give yourself to reading. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read. Renounce as much as you will all like literature, but study as much as possible sound theological works, especially the Puritanic writers and expositions of the Bible. The best way for you to spend your leisure is to be either reading or praying. And now to SWRB's reading of the Existence and Attributes of God, which we hope you find to be a great blessing, and which we pray draws you nearer to the Lord Jesus Christ, for he is the way, the truth, and the life. And no man cometh unto the Father but by him. John 14, verse 6. 1. The world hath been but of a short standing. It is not yet 6,000 years since the foundations of it were laid, and therefore it cannot have a boundless excellency, as that God who hath been from everlasting doth possess. If Adam had lived to this day, and been as absolute lord of his posterity as he was of the other creatures, had it been a competent object to take up his heart? Had he not been a madman to have preferred this little created pleasure before an everlasting, uncreated God, a thing that had a dependent beginning before that which had an independent eternity? 2. The beauties of the world are transitory and perishing. The whole world is nothing else but a fluid thing. The fashion of it is a pageantry passing away, 1 Corinthians 7:31. Though the glories of it might be conceived greater than they are, yet they are not consistent but transient. There cannot be an entire enjoyment of them, because they grow up and expire every moment, and slip away between our fingers while we are using them. Have we not heard of God's dispersing the great empires like chaff before a whirlwind, or as smoke out of a chimney, Hosea 13:3, which though it appears as a compacted cloud, as if it would choke the sun, it quickly scattered into several parts of the air and becomes invisible? Nettles have often been heirs to stately palaces, as God threatens Israel, Hosea 9:6. We cannot promise ourselves overnight anything the next day. A kingdom with the glory of a throne may be cut off in a morning, Hosea 10:15. The new wine may be taken from the mouth when the vintage is ripe. The devouring locust may snatch away both the hopes of that and the harvest, Joel 1:15. They are, therefore, things which are not, and nothing can be a fit object for confidence or affection. Wilt thou set thy eyes upon that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings, Proverbs 23:5. They are not proper beings, because they are not stable, not fit, but fitting. They are not because they may not be the next moment to us what they are this. They are but cisterns, not springs, and broken cisterns, not sound and stable. No solidarity in their substance, no stability in their duration. What a foolish thing is it, then, to prefer a transient felicity, a mere nullity, before an eternal God? What a senseless thing would it be in a man to prefer the map of a kingdom which the hand of a child can tear in pieces, before the kingdom shadowed by it? How much more inexcusable is it to value things that are so far balances of an eternity, were the things of the world more glorious than they are, yet they are but as a counterfeit sun in a cloud, which comes short of the true sun in the heavens, but in glory and duration, both in glory and duration. And to esteem them before God is inconceivably baser than if a man should value a parti-coloured bubble in the air before a durable rock of diamonds. The comforts of this world are as candles that will end in a snuff, whereas the felicity that flows from an eternal God is like the sun that shines more and more to a perfect day. 3. They cannot therefore be fit for a soul which is made to have an interest in God's eternity. The soul being of a perpetual nature was made for the fruition of an eternal good. Without such a good, it can never be perfect. Perfection, that noble thing, riseth not from anything in this world, nor is a title due to a soul while in this world. It is then they are said to be made perfect, when they arrive at that entire conjunction with the eternal God in another life. Hebrews 12:23. The soul cannot be ennobled by an acquaintance with these things, or established by a dependence on them. They cannot confer what a rational nature should desire, or supply it with what it wants. The soul hath a resemblance to God in a post-eternity. Why should it be drawn aside by the blandishments of earthly things, to neglect its true establishment, and lackey after the body, which is but the shadow of the soul, and was made to follow it and serve it? But while it busieth itself altogether in the concerns of a perishing body, and seeks satisfaction in things that glide away, it becomes rather a body than soul, descends below its nature, which approaches that God who hath imprinted upon it an image of his own eternity, and loseth the comfort of the everlastingness of its Creator. How shall the whole world, if our lives were as durable as that, be a happy eternity to us, who have souls that will survive all the delights of it, which must fry in those flames that shall fire the whole frame of nature at the general conflagration of the world? 2 Peter 3:10. 4. Therefore, let us provide for a happy interest in the eternity of God. Man is made for an eternal state. The soul has such a perfection in its nature that it is fit for eternity and cannot display all its operations but in eternity. To an eternity it must go and live as long as God lives, himself lives. The things of a short duration are not proportioned to a soul made for an eternal continuance. To see that it be a comfortable eternity is worth all our care. Man is a forecasting creature, and considers not only the present, but the future too, in his provisions for his family, and shall he disgrace his nature in casting off all considerations of a future eternity? Get possession, therefore, of the eternal God. A portion in this life is the lot of those who shall be forever miserable. Psalm 17:14. But God, an everlasting portion, is the lot of them that are designed for happiness. God is my portion forever. Psalm 73:26. Time is short. 1 Corinthians 7:29. The whole time for which God designed this building of the world is of a little compass. It is a stage erected for rational creatures to act their parts upon for a few thousand years, the greatest part of which time is run out, and then shall time, like a rivulet, fall into the sea of eternity from whence it sprung. As time is but a slip of eternity, so it will end in eternity. Our advantages consist in the present instant. What is past never promised to return, and cannot be fetched back by all our vows. What is future, we cannot promise ourselves to enjoy. We may be snatched away before it comes, Every minute that passeth speaks the few are remaining till the time of death. And as we are every hour further from our beginning, we are nearer our end. The child born this day grows up to grow nothing at last. In all ages there is but a step between us and death. As David said of himself, 1 Samuel 20, verse 3, the little time that remains for the devil till the day of judgment envenoms his wrath. He rageth because his time is short. Revelation 12, 12. The little time that remains between this moment and our death should quicken our diligence to inherit the endless and unchangeable eternity of God. 5. Often meditate on the eternity of God. The holiness, power, and eternity of God are the fundamental articles of all religion, upon which the whole body of it leans. His holiness for conformity to him, his power and eternity for the support of faith and hope. The strong and incessant cries of the four beasts, representing that Christian church, are holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, which was, and is to come. Revelation 4, 8. Though his power is intimated, yet the chiefest are his holiness, three times expressed, and his eternity, which is repeated, who lives for ever and ever. Verse 9. This ought to be the constant practice in the church of the Gentiles, which this book chiefly respects. The meditation of his converting grace manifested to Paul ravished the apostle's heart, but not without the triumphant consideration of his immortality and eternity, which are the principal parts of the doxology. Now unto the King eternal, immortal, invisible, the only wise God, be honour and glory for ever and ever. 1 Timothy 1, 15-17. It could be no great transport to the Spirit to consider him glorious without considering him immortal. The unconfinedness of his perfections in regard of time presents the soul with a matter of the greatest complacency. The happiness of our souls depends upon his other attributes, but the perpetuity of it upon his eternity. It is a comfort to view his immense wisdom, his overflowing goodness, his tender mercy, his unerring truth. What comfort there were there in any of those if it were a wisdom that could be baffled, a goodness that could be damped, a mercy that can expire, and a truth that can perish with the subject of it? Without eternity, what were all his other perfections but as glorious yet withering flowers, a great but a decaying beauty? By a frequent meditation of God's eternity, we should become more sensible of our own vanity and the world's triflingness. How nothing would all other things appear in our eyes. How coldly should we desire them? How feebly should we place any trust in them? Should we not think ourselves worthy of contempt, to dote upon a perishing glory, to expect support from an arm of flesh, when there is an eternal beauty to ravish us, an eternal arm to protect us? Asaph, when he considered God a portion forever, thought nothing of the glories of the earth or the beauties of the created heavens worth his appetite or complacency, but God. Psalm 73:25-26. Besides, an elevated frame of heart at the consideration of God's eternity would batter down the strongholds and engines of any temptation. A slight temptation will not know where to find and catch hold of a soul high and hid in a meditation of it. And if it doth, there will not be wanting from hence preservatives to resist and conquer it. What transitory pleasures will not the thoughts of God's eternity stifle? When this work busieth a soul, it is too great to suffer it to descend, to listen to a sleeveless errand from hell or the world. The wanton allurements of the flesh will be put off with indignation. the prophets of the world will be ridiculous when they are cast into the balance with the eternity of God. With sticking in our thoughts, we shall not be so easy a prey for the foulest jinn. Let us therefore often meditate upon this, but not in a bare speculation, without engaging our affections and making every notion of the divine eternity end in a suitable impression upon our hearts. This would be much like the disciples gazing upon the heavens at the ascension of their master, while they forgot the practice of his orders, Acts 1:11. We may also find something of the nature of God and lose ourselves not only in eternity, but to eternity. 2. And hence, the second part of the exhortation is to something which concerns us with a respect to God. 1. If God be eternal, how worthy is he of our choicest affections and strongest desires of communion with him? Is not everything to be valued according to the greatness of his being? How then should we love him, who is not only lovely in his nature, but eternally lovely, having from everlasting all those perfections centered in himself which appear in time? If everything be lovely, by how much more it partakes of the nature of God, who is the chief good? How much more infinite lovely is God, who is superior to all other goods, and eternally so? Not a God of a few minutes, months, years, or millions of years, not of the dregs of time, or the top of time, but of eternity, above time, inconceivably immense beyond time. The loving him infinitely, perpetually, is an act of homage due to him for his eternal excellency. We may give him the one, since our souls are immortal, though we cannot the other, because they are finite. Since he encloses in himself all the excellencies of heaven and earth forever, he should have an affection, not only of time in this world, but of eternity in future. And if we did not owe him a love for what we are by him, we owe him a love for what he is in himself, and more for what he is than for what he is to us. He is more worthy of our affections because he is the eternal God than because he is our creator. Because he is more excellent in his nature than in his transient actions, the beings of his goodness to us are to direct our thoughts and affections to him, but his own eternal excellency ought to be the ground and foundation of our affections to him. And truly, since nothing but God is eternal, nothing but God is worth the loving, and we do but a just right to our love, to pitch it upon that which can always possess us and be possessed by us, upon an object that cannot deceive our affection, and put it out of countenance by a dissolution. And if our happiness consists in being like to God, we should imitate him in loving him as he loves himself, and as long as he loves himself. God cannot do more to himself than love himself. He can make no addition to his essence, nor diminution from it. What should we do less to an eternal being than to bestow affections upon him like his own to himself? Since we can find nothing so durable as himself, for which we should love it? 2. He is worthy of our best service. The Ancient of Days is to be served before all that are younger than himself. Our best obedience is due to God as a God of unconfined excellency. Everything that is excellent deserves a veneration suitable to its excellency. As God is infinite, he has right to a boundless service. As he is eternal, he has right to a perpetual service. A service is a debt of justice upon the account of the excellency of his nature, so a perpetual service is as much a debt of justice upon the account of his eternity. If God be infinite and eternal, he merits the honour and comportment from his creatures. suited to the unlimited perfection of his nature and the duration of his being. How worthy is the psalmist's resolution? I will sing unto the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have any being. Psalm 104:33. It is the use he makes of the endless duration of the glory of God, and will extend to all other service as well as praise. To serve other things, or to serve ourselves, is too vast a service upon that which is nothing. In devoting ourselves to God, we serve him that is, that was, so that he never began, is to become, so as that he never shall end, by whom all things are what they are, who hath both eternal knowledge to remember our service, and eternal goodness to reward it. Discourse 6. On the immutability of God. Psalm 102:26-27. They shall perish, but thou shalt endure. Yea, all of them shall wax old as a garment, and as a vesture shalt thou change them, and they shall be changed. But thou art the same, and thy years shall have no end. The psalm contains a complaint of a people pressed with a great calamity. Some think of the Jewish church in Babylon. Others think the psalmist doth here personate mankind lying under a state of corruption, because he wishes for the coming of the Messiah to accomplish that redemption promised by God and needed by them. Indeed, the title of the psalm is A Prayer of the Afflicted When He Is Overwhelmed, and pours out his complaint before the Lord, whether afflicted with the sense of corruption or with the sense of oppression. And the redemption by the Messiah, which is the ancient church looked upon as the fountain of their deliverance from a sinful and servile bondage, is in this psalm spoken of. A set time appointed for the discovery of his mercy to Zion, verse 13, an appearance in glory to build up Zion, verse 16. The loosing of the prisoner by redemption, and them that are appointed to death, verse 20. The calling of the Gentiles, verse 22. And the latter part of the psalm, wherein are the verses I have read, are applied to Christ, Hebrews 1. Whatsoever the design of the psalmist might be, many things are intermingled that concern the kingdom of the Messiah and redemption by Christ. Some make three parts of the psalm. 1. A petition plainly delivered, verse 1 and 2. Hear my cry, prayer, O Lord, and let my cry come unto thee, etc. 2. The petition strongly and argumentatively enforced and pleaded, verse 3. From the misery of the petitioner in himself, and his approach from his enemies. 3. An acting of faith in the expectation of an answer in the general redemption promised. Verse 12 and 13. But thou, O Lord, shalt endure forever. Thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion. The heathen shall fear thy name. The first part is the petition pleaded. The second part is the petition answered, in an assurance that there should in time be a full deliverance. The design of the penman is to confirm the church in the truth of the divine promises, that though the foundations of the world should be ripped up, and the heavens clattered together, and the whole fabric of them be unpinned and fall to pieces, the firmest parts of it dissolved, yet the church should continue in its stability, because it stands not upon the changeableness of creatures, but is built upon the immutable rock of the truth of God, which is as little subject to change as his essence. They shall perish. Thou shalt change them. As he had before ascribed to God the foundations of heaven and earth, verse 25, Surely ascribes to God here the destruction of them. Both the beginning and end of the world are here ascertained. There is nothing, indeed, from the present appearance of the things that can demonstrate the cessation of the world. The heaven and earth stand firm. The motions of the heavenly bodies are the same. Their beauty is not decayed. Individuals corrupt, but the species and kinds remain. The successions of the years observe their due order, but the sin of man renders the change of the present appearance of the world necessary to accomplish the design of God for the glory of his elect. The heavens do naturally perish, as some fancied an old age of the world, wherein it must necessarily decay, as the bodies of animals do, or that the parts of the heavens are broken off by their rubbing one against another in their motion and falling to the earth, are the seeds of those things that grow among us. The earth and heavens. He names here the most stable parts of the world and the most beautiful parts of the creation, those that are freest from corruptibility and change, to illustrate thereby the immutability of God, that though the heavens and earth have a prerogative of fixedness above other parts of the world, and the creatures that reside below, the heavens remain the same as they were created, and the centre of the earth retains its fixedness, and are as beautiful and fresh in their age as they were in their youth many years ago. Notwithstanding the change of the elements, fire and water being often turned into air, so that there may remain but little of that air which was first created by reason of the continual transmutation. Yet this firmness of the earth and heavens is not to be regarded in comparison of the unmovableness and fixedness of the being of God. As their beauty comes short of the glory of his being, so does their firmness come short of his stability. Some, by heavens and earth, understand the creatures which reside in the earth, and those which are in the air, which is called heaven, often in Scripture. But the ruin and fall of these beings seen every day have but no illustration of the unchangeableness of God. They shall perish. They shall be changed. One, they may perish, say some. They have it not from themselves that they do not perish, but from me, who didst endue them with an incorruptible nature. They shall perish if thou speakest a word. Thou canst with as much ease destroy them as thou didst create them. But the psalmist speaks not of their possibility, but of the certainty of their perishing. Two, they shall perish in their qualities and motion, not in their substance, say others. They shall cease from that motion which is designed properly for the generation and corruption of things in the earth, but in regard of their substance and beauty, they shall remain. As when the strings or wheels of a clock or watch are taken off, the material parts remain, though the motion of it and the use for discovering the time of the day ceases. To perish does not signify always a falling into nothing, an annihilation, by which both the matter and form are destroyed, but a ceasing of the present appearance of them, a ceasing to be what they now are, as a man is said to perish when he dies, whereas the better part of man does not cease to be. The figure of the body moulders away, and the matter of it returns to dust. But the soul, being immortal, ceases not to act, when the body, by reason of the absence of the soul, is incapable of acting. So the heavens shall perish. The appearance of they now have shall vanish, and a more glorious and incorruptible frame be erected by the power and goodness of God. The dissolution of heaven and earth is meant by the word perish. The raising a new frame is signified by the word change, as if the Spirit of God would prevent any wrong meaning of the word perish. By alleviating the sense of that, by another which signifies only a mutation and change, as when we change a habit and garment, we quit the old to receive the new. As a garment, as a vesture, thou shalt change them, thou shalt fold them up. The heavens are compared to a curtain, Psalm 104:2, and shall in due time be folded up as clothes and curtains are. As a garment encompasses the whole body, so do the heavens encircle the earth. Some say, as a garment is folded up to be laid aside, that when there is need it may be taken again for use, so shalt thou fold up the heavens like a garment, that when they are repaired, thou mayest again stretch them out about the earth. Thou shalt fold them up, so that what did appear shall not now appear. It may be illustrated by the metaphor of a scroll or book, which the Spirit of God useth, Isaiah 34:4 and Revelation 6:14. The heavens departed as a scroll when it is rolled together. When a book is rolled up or shut, nothing can be read in it till it be opened again. So the face of the heavens, wherein the stars are as letters declaring the glory of God, shall be shut or rolled together, so that nothing shall appear till by its renovation it be opened again. As a garment it shall be changed, not to be used in the same fashion, and for the same use again. It seems, indeed, to be for the worse. An old garment is not changed but into rags, to be put to other uses, and afterwards thrown upon the dunghill. But similitudes are not to be pressed too far, and this will not agree with the new heavens and new earth, physically so, as well as metaphorically so. It is not likely the heavens will be put to a worse use than God designed them for in creation. However, a change as a garment speaks not of total corruption, but an alteration of qualities, as a garment not to be used in the same fashion as before. We may observe that it is probable the world shall not be annihilated, but refined. It shall lose its present form and fashion, but not its foundation. Indeed, as God raised it from nothing, so he can reduce it into nothing. Yet it doth not appear that God will annihilate it, and utterly destroy both the matter and form of it. Part shall be consumed, and part purified. 2 Peter 3:12-13. The heavens shall be on fire and dissolved. Nevertheless we, according to his promise, look for a new heaven and a new earth. They shall be melted down as gold by the artificer, to be refined from its dross, and wrought into a more beautiful fashion, that they may serve the design of God for those that shall reside therein, a new world wherein righteousness shall dwell, the apostle opposing it thereby to the old world wherein wickedness did reside. The heavens are to be purged, as the vessels that held the sin offering were to be purified by the fire of the sanctuary. God indeed will take down this scaffold, which he hath built to publish his glory. As every individual hath a certain term of his duration, so an end is appointed for the universal nature of heaven and earth. Isaiah 51:6. The heavens shall vanish like smoke, which disappears. As smoke is resolved and attenuated into air, not alike annihilated, so shall the world assume a new face, and have a greater clearness and splendour, as the bodies of men, dissolved into dust, shall have more glorious qualities at their resurrection, as a vessel of gold is melted down to remove the batterings in it, and receive a more comely form by the skill of the workmen. 1. The world was not destroyed by the deluge. It was rather washed by water than consumed. So shall be rather refined by the last fire than lie under an irrevocable ruin. 2. It is not likely God would liken the everlastingness of his covenant and the perpetuity of his spiritual Israel to the duration of the ordinances of the heavens, as he doth in Jeremiah 31, 35, 36, if they were wholly to depart from before him. Though that place may only tend to an assurance of a church in the world while the world endures, yet it would be but small comfort if the happiness of believers should endure no longer than the heavens and earth, if they were to have a total period. 3. Besides, the bodies of the saints must have place for their support to move in, and glorious objects suited to those glorious senses which shall be restored to them, not in any carnal way which our Saviour rejects when he saith, there is no eating or drinking or marrying, etc., in the other world, but whereby they may glorify God, though how or in what manner their senses shall be used, would be rashness to determine. Only something is necessary for the corporeal state of men, that they may be an employment for their senses as well as their souls. 4. Again, how could the creature, the world, or any part of it, be said to be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the sons of God, if the whole frame of heaven and earth were to be annihilated? Romans 8:21. The Apostle says also that the creature waits with an earnest expectation for this manifestation of the sons of God, verse 19, which would have no foundation if the whole frame should be reduced to nothing. What joyful expectation can there be in any of a total ruin? How should the creature be capable of partaking in this glorious liberty of the sons of God? As the world, for the sin of man, lost its first dignity and was cursed after the fall, and the beauty bestowed upon it by creation debased, so it shall recover that ancient glory when he shall be fully restored by the resurrection to that dignity he lost by his first sin. A man shall be freed from his corruptibility to receive that glory which is prepared for him. So shall the creatures be freed from that imperfection or corruptibility, those stains and spots upon the face of them, to receive a new glory suited to their nature and answerable to the design of God when the glorious liberty of the saints shall be accomplished. As when a prince's nuptials are solemnized, the whole country echoes with joy, so the inanimate creatures, when the time of the marriage of the Lamb is come, shall have a delight and pleasure from that renovation. The Apostle sets forth the whole world as a person groaning, and the Scripture is frequent in such metaphors, as when the creatures are said to wait upon God and to be troubled, the hills are said to leap and the mountains to rejoice. Psalm 104:27-29. The creature is said to groan, as the heavens are said to declare the glory of God, passively, naturally, not rationally. It is not like the angels are here meant, though they cannot but desire it, since they are affected with the dishonor and reproach God hath in the world. They cannot but long for the restoration of his honor in the restoration of the creature to its true end. And indeed the angels are employed to serve man in his sinful state, and cannot but in holiness wish the creature freed from his corruption. Nor is it meant of the new creatures, which have the first fruits of the Spirit, those he brings in afterwards, groaning and waiting for their adoption, verse 23, where he distinguishes the rational creature from the creature he had spoken of before. If he had meant the believing creature by that creature that desired the liberty of the sons of God, what need had there been of that additional distinction? And not only they, but we also had the first fruits of the Spirit grown within ourselves. Whereby it seems he means some creatures below rational creatures, since neither angels nor blessed souls can be said to have travail in pain. With what distress has a woman in travail hath, as the wind signifies, who perform the work joyfully which God sets upon them upon. If the creatures be subject to vanity by the sin of man, they shall also partake of a happiness by the restoration of man. The earth hath borne thorns and thistles, and venomous beasts. The air hath had its tempests and infectious qualities. Water hath caught its floods and deluges. The creature hath been abused to luxury and intemperance, and been tyrannized over by man, contrary to the end of its creation. It is convenient that some time should be allotted for the creature's attaining its due end, and that it may partake of the peace of man, as it hath done of the fruits of his sin. Otherwise it would seem that sin had prevailed more than grace, and would have had more power to deface than grace to restore things into their due order again. Due order. 5. Again, upon what account should the psalmist exhort the heavens to rejoice, and the earth to be glad, when God comes to judge the world with righteousness? Psalm 96:11-13. If they should be annihilated and sunk forever into nothing. It would seem, said Dale, to be an impertinent figure if the judge of the world brought to them a total destruction, an entire ruin, could not be a matter of triumph to creatures who naturally have that instinct or inclination put into them by their Creator to preserve themselves and to effect their own preservation. 6. Again, the Lord is to rejoice in his works. Psalm 104:31. The glory of the Lord shall endure forever. The Lord shall rejoice in his works, not have, but shall rejoice in his works, in the works of creation, which the psalmist had enumerated, and which is the whole scope of the psalm. And he intimates that it is part of the glory of the Lord which endures forever. That is, his manifestated glory, to rejoice in his works. The glory of the Lord must be understood with reference to the creation he has spoken of before. How short was that joy God had in his works, after he had sent them beautified out of his hand? How soon did he repent, not only that he had made man, but was grieved at the heart also, that he made the other creatures which man's sin had disordered. Genesis 6:7. What joy can God have in them, since the curse upon the entrance of sin into the world remains upon them? If they are to be annihilated upon the full restoration of his holiness, what time will God have to rejoice in the other works of his creation? It is the joy of God to see all his works in due order, every one pointing to their true end, marching together in their excellency, according to his first intendment in their creation. Did God create the world to perform its end only for one day? Scarce so much. If Adam fell the very first day of his creation, what would have been their end if Adam had been confirmed in a state of happiness as the angels were? 'Tis likely will be answered and performed upon the complete restoration of man to that happy state from whence he fell. What artificer compiles a work by his skill but to rejoice in it? And shall God have no joy from the works of his hands? Since God can only rejoice in goodness, the creatures must have that goodness restored to them, which God pronounced them to have at the first creation, and which he ordained them for, before he can again rejoice in his works. The goodness of the creatures is the glory and joy of God. Inference 1. We may infer from hence what a base and vile thing sin is, which lays the foundation of the world's change. Sin brings it to a decrepit age. Sin overturned the whole work of God, Genesis 3:17, so that to render it useful to its proper end, there is a necessity of a kind of a new creating it. This causes God to fire the earth for a purification of it from that infection and contagion brought upon it by the apostasy and corruption of man. It has served sinful man, and therefore must undergo a purging flame to be fit to serve the holy and righteous Creator. A sin is so riveted in the body of man that there is need of a change by death to raise it out. So hath the curse of for sin got so deep into the bowels of the world that there is need of a change by fire to refine it for its master's use. Let us look upon sin with no other notion than as the object of God's hatred, the cause of his grief in the creatures, and the spring of the pain and ruin of the world. 2. How foolish a thing is it to set our hearts upon that which will perish, and be no more what it is now. The heavens and the earth, the solidest and firmest parts of the creation, shall not continue in the posture they are. They must perish and undergo a refining change. How feeble and weak are the other parts of the creation, the little creatures walking upon and fluttering about the world, that are perishing and dying every day, and we scarce see them clothed with life and beauty this day, but they wither and are despoiled of all the next, and are such frail things fit objects for our everlasting spirits and affections. Though the daily employment of the heavens is the declaration of the glory of God, Psalm 19:1, yet neither this, nor their harmony, order, beauty, amazing greatness and glory of them, shall preserve them from a dissolution and melting at the presence of the Lord, though they have remained in the same posture from the creation to this day, and are of so great antiquity, yet they must bow down to a change before the will and word of their Creator, and shall we rest upon that which will vanish like smoke? Shall we take any creature for our support like ice that will crack under our feet, and must, by the order of their Lord Creator, deceive our hopes? Perishing things can be no support to the soul. If we would have rest, we must run to God and rest in God. How contemptible should that be to us, whose fashion shall pass away, which shall not endure long in its present form and appearance, contemptible as a rest, not contemptible as a work of God, contemptible as an end, not contemptible as means to attain an end. If these must be changed, how unworthy are other things to be the centre of our souls, that change in our very using of them, and slide away in our very enjoyment of them. Thou art the same. The essence of God, with all the perfections of his nature, are pronounced the same, without any variation from eternity to eternity, so that the text doth not only assert the eternal duration of God, but his immutability in that duration. His eternity is signified in that expression, thou shalt endure. His immutability in this, thou art the same. To endure argues indeed his immutability as well as eternity, for what endures is not changed. And what is changed does not endure, but thou art the same, does not fully signify it. It could not be the same if he could be changed into any other thing than what he is. The psalmist therefore puts not thou hast been or shalt be, but thou art the same without any alteration. Thou art the same, that is the same God, the same in essence and nature, the same in will and purpose. Thou dost change all other things as thou pleasest, but thou art immutable in every respect, and receivest no shadow of change, though never so light and small. The psalmist here alludes to the name Jehovah, I am, and does not only ascribe immutability to God, but exclude everything else from partaking in that perfection. All things else are tottering. God sees other things in continual motion under his feet, like water passing away, and no more seen, while he remains fixed and immovable. His wisdom and power, his knowledge and will are always the same. His essence can receive no alteration, neither by itself, nor by any external cause, whereas other things either naturally decline to destruction, pass from one term to another, till they come to their period, or shall at the last day be wrapped up, after God hath completed his will in them, and by them, as a man doth a garment he intends to repair, and transform to another use. So then in the text, God as immutable, is opposed to all creatures as perishing and changeable. Doctrine. God is unchangeable in his essence, nature, and perfections. Immutability and eternity are linked together, and indeed true eternity is true immutability, whence eternity is defined the possession of an immutable life. Yet immutability differs from eternity in our conception. Immutability respects the essence or existence of a thing. Eternity respects the duration of a being in that state, or rather, immutability is the state itself. Eternity is the measure of that state. A thing is said to be changed when it is otherwise now in regard of nature, state, will, or any quality that it was before, when either something is added to it or taken from it, when it either loses or acquires. But now it is the essential property of God not to have any accession to or diminution of his essence or attributes, but to remain entirely the same. He wants nothing. He loses nothing, but doth uniformly exist by himself, without any new nature, new thoughts, new will, new purpose, or new place. This unchangeableness of God was anciently represented by the figure of a cube, a piece of metal or wood framed four square, when every side is exactly the same in quality. Cast it which way you will, it will always be in the same posture, because it is equal to itself in all its dimensions. He was therefore said to be the centre of all things, and other things the circumference. The centre is never moved, while the circumference is. It remains immovable in the midst of the circle. There is no variableness, nor shadow of turning with him. James 1:17. The moon hath her spots, so hath the sun. There is a mixture of light and darkness, and hath its changes. Sometimes it is in the increase, sometimes in the wane. It is always either gaining or losing, or by the turnings and motions, either of the heavenly bodies or of the earth. It is in its eclipse, by the interposition of the earth between that and the sun. The sun also hath its diurnal and annual motion. It riseth and sets, and puts on a different face. Doth not always shine with the noonday light. It is sometimes veiled with clouds and vapours. It is always going from one tropic to another, whereby it makes various shadows on the earth, and produces the various seasons of the year. It is not always in our hemisphere, nor doth it always shine in equal force and brightness in it. Such shadows and variations have no place in the eternal Father of lights. He hath not the least spot or diminution of brightness, neither can cloud him or eclipse him. For the better understanding this perfection of God, I shall premise three things. 1. The immutability of God is a perfection. Immutability considered in itself, without relation to other things, is not a perfection. It is the greatest misery and imperfection of the evil angels that they are immutable in malice against God. But as God is infinite in essence, infinitely good, wise, holy, so it is a perfection necessary to his nature that he should be immutably all this, all excellency, goodness, wisdom, immutably all that he is. Without this, he would be an imperfect being. Are not the angels in heaven, who are confirmed in a holy and happy state, more perfect than when they were in the possibility of committing evil and becoming miserable? Are not the saints in heaven, whose wills by grace do unalterably plead to God and goodness, more perfect than if they were as Adam in paradise, capable of losing their felicity as well as preserving it? We count a rock, in regard of its stability, more excellent than the dust of the ground, or a feather that is tossed about with every wind. Is it not also the perfection of the body to have a constant tenor of health, and the glory of man not to walk aside from what is just and right by the persuasions of any temptations? 2. Immutability is a glory belonging to all the attributes of God. It is not a single perfection of the divine nature, nor is it limited to particular objects thus and thus disposed. Mercy and justice have their distinct objects and distinct acts. Mercy is conversant about a penitent. Justice conversant about an obstinate sinner. In our notion and conception of the divine perfections, his perfections are different. The wisdom of God is not his power, nor his power his holiness. But immutability is the centre wherein they all unite. There is not one perfection, but may be said to be, and truly is, immutable. None of them will appear so glorious without this being, the Son of immutability, which renders them highly excellent without the least shadow of imperfection. How cloudy would his blessedness be if it were changeable? How dim his wisdom if it might be obscured? How feeble his power if it were capable to be sickly and languish? How would mercy lose much of his lustre if it could change into wrath, and justice much of its dread if it could be turned into mercy, while the object of justice remains unfit for mercy, and one that hath need of mercy continues only fit for the divine fury? But unchangeableness is a thread that runs through the whole web. It is the enamel of all the rest. None of them without it could look with a triumphant aspect. His power is unchangeable. In the Lord Jehovah is everlasting strength. Isaiah 26:4. His mercy and his holiness endure forever. He never could, nor ever can, look upon iniquity. Habakkuk 1:13. How is a rock in the righteousness of his ways, the truth of his word, the holiness of his proceedings, and the rectitude of his nature? All are expressed, Deuteronomy 32:4. He is a rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are judgment. A God of truth, and without iniquity, just and right is he. All that we consider in God is unchangeable, for his essence and his properties are the same, and therefore what is necessarily belonging to the essence of God belongs also to every perfection of the nature of God. None of them can receive any addition or diminution. From the unchangeableness of his nature, the Apostle, James 1:17, infers the unchangeableness of his holiness and himself. In Malachi 3:6, the unchangeableness of his counsel. 3. Unchangeableness that necessarily pertain to the nature of God. It is of the same necessity with the rectitude of his nature. He can no more be changeable in his essence than he can be unrighteous in his actions. God is a necessary being. He is necessarily what he is, and therefore is unchangeably what he is. Mutability belongs to contingency. If any creature perfection of his nature could be separated from him, he would cease to be God. What did not possess the whole nature of God, could not have the essence of God. It is reciprocated with the nature of God. Whatsoever is immutable by nature is God. Whatsoever is God is immutable by nature. Some creatures are immutable by his grace and power. God is holy, happy, wise, good by his essence. Angels and men are made holy, wise, happy, strong and good by qualities and graces. The holiness, happiness and wisdom of saints and angels, as they had a beginning, so they are capable of increase and diminution and of an end also. For their standing is not from themselves or from the nature of created strength, holiness or wisdom, which in themselves are apt to fail and finally to decay, but from the stability and confirmation they have by the gift and grace of God. The heaven and earth shall be changed, and after that renewal and reparation they shall not be changed. Our bodies after the resurrection shall not be changed, but forever be made conformable to the glorious body of Christ. Philippians 3:21. But this is by the powerful grace of God, so that indeed those things may be said afterwards, rather to be unchanged than unchangeable, because they are not so by nature, but my sovereign dispensation. As creatures have not necessary beings, so they have not necessary immutability. Necessity of being, and therefore immutability of being, belongs by nature only to God. Otherwise, if there were any change in God, he would be sometimes what he was not, and would cease to be what he was, which is against the nature, and indeed against the natural notion of a deity. Let us see then, one, in what regards God is immutable. Two, prove that God is immutable. Three, that this is proper to God and incommunicable to any creature. Four, some propositions to clear the unchangeableness of God from anything that seems contrary to it. 5. The use. 1. In what respects God is unchangeable? 1. God is unchangeable in his essence. He is unalterably fixed in his being, so that not a particle of it can be lost from it, nor a mite added to it. If a man continue in being as long as the Methuselah, 960 years, yet there is not a day, nay an hour, wherein there is not some alteration in his substance, though no substantial part is wanting, yet there is an addition to him by his food, a diminution of something by his labour, he is always making some acquisition or suffering some loss, but in God there can be no alteration by the accession of anything to make his substance greater or better, or by diminution to make it less or worse. He who hath not being from another cannot but be always what he is. God is the first being, an independent being. He was not produced of himself or of any other, but by nature always hath been, and therefore cannot but, by himself or by any other, be changed from what he is in his own nature. That which is not may as well assume to itself a being, as he who hath, and is all being, hath the least change from what he is. Again, because he is a spirit, he is not subject to those mutations which are found in corporeal and bodily natures. Because he is an absolute simple spirit, not having the least particle of composition, but he is not capable of those changes which may be in created spirits. 1. If his essence were mutable, God would not truly be. It could not be truly said by himself, I am that I am, Exodus 3:14. If he were such a thing or being at this time, and a different being at another time. whatever is changed properly is not, because it does not remain to be what it was. That which is changed was something, is something, and will be something. A being remains to that thing which is changed. Yet though it may be said such a thing is, yet it may also be said such a thing is not, because it is not what it was in its first being. It is not now what it was. It is now what it was not. It is another thing than that it was. It was another thing than it is. It will be another thing than what it is or was. It is indeed a being, but a different being from what it was before. But if God were changed, it could not be said of him that he is, but it might also be said of him that he is not. Or if he were changeable, or could be changed, it might be said of him, he will not be what he is, or he will not be what he is, or there will be, or may be some difference in his being, and so God would not be, I am, that I am. And though he could not cease utterly to be, yet he would cease to be what he was before.
This Reformation audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalogue containing classic and contemporary Puritan Reform books, CDs and much more at great discounts, are on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, AB, Canada, T6L3T5. If you do not have a web connection, please request a free printed catalogue. If you do have a web connection and would like to be added to our email list, please send an email to add@swrb.com or swrb@swrb.com with the word add in the subject line. SWRB's email list is a double opt-in list, so once you've sent us your email address, you will be asked by email to confirm that you want to join our list using the email address you have supplied. Your email information will be kept confidential, and you can easily remove yourself from our email list by simply emailing us at swrb@swrb.com with the word remove in the subject line. Once you are on our email list, you will be alerted to all the new free Reformation resources, free MP3s, free electronic books and texts, etc. SWRB makes available on the web, as well as at times, to our best discounts and super specials. We also encourage you to reproduce this audio resource and to pass it on to your friends, but we only authorize this as long as the full contents of the message, including the header and trailer, is not altered in any way, and as long as the audio file or cassette is given away for free. Thank you again for listening to this SWRB reading, and remember that Isaiah 26:3 states, "Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee." 2 Corinthians 13:11 concludes, "Finally, brethren, farewell. Be perfect. Be of good comfort. Be of one mind. Live in peace. And the God of love and peace shall be with you."